Now is the time where we're going to really hear one of our scholars in nursing, Professor Rucker. I just met him a while ago asking about his information. And I told him, congratulations, the lecture will be really fantastic. Because the title is very clear, that is our need, that we need really to look into how can really we bridge the gap between research and the actual nursing practice. This is what we're going to listen from our coming speaker, Professor Roger Weston. Professor Roger Weston is a graduate of the University of Edinburgh with the PhD in biochemistry, and also from the University of Sheffield, who qualified in nursing at East George's Hospital, London. Working in the care of older people, he has a special interest in feeding and nutritional problem of older people with dementia. He is editor-in-chief of Journal of Advanced Nursing and editor of Nursing Open. Frequent visitor to Far Eastern and many countries, Europe, Australia, China. Please share me welcoming Professor Rigo. Professor.
Thank you. Right, once again, thank you very much. I feel very lucky to be giving a second talk today. Those of you who were here this morning might not feel so lucky. Let me just see if I can get this done. All right, everything's working well so far. Good. We're okay. Thank you very much. Right. 20 minutes, so I'll keep the time. Look at my watch. That's always the best way to do it. And thank you for the introduction and for building me up so well. I'm not really going to give a very scholarly talk, in fact. I'm going to talk about, bridging the evidence practice gap in nursing, but I'm going to try not to do it from a sort of theoretical perspective, because that really is pretty boring, I think. I'm going to run through some of the theory quickly and get on to one very practical example. And the practical example is going to pick up on many of the things that people have been talking about today, about empowerment and bottom-up organisation rather than top-down organisation. But we'll get to that in a minute. For those of you who weren't here this morning, welcome from the University of Hull, which is where I work at the moment. And the sun sometimes shines there, but it's often cold and snowing as well, very different from Riyadh and Saudi Arabia. So basically, evidence-based practice is everyone's business, I think. Academics, researchers and clinicians. We can't just avoid it like the person who's been painting the line on the road here has been painting it. I think there's a feeling that as academics, we try to leave evidence-based practice to the people who are in practice, and the people in practice tend to look the other way and leave the evidence-based practice to us, or at least the generation of the evidence. And there is I don't want to make too much about the gap between evidence and practice, but there is definitely a need to try and implement evidence into practice, otherwise what's the point? And there are many national initiatives and international initiatives to do this. There are national initiatives in the UK, particularly the National Institute for Clinical Excellence and other organisations and associated with our National Health Service. I honestly don't think these are necessarily the best way to get evidence into practice because they're top down. And the National Health Service in the UK is one of the most top down organisations you could possibly encounter. But anyway, enough of the politics. Why do we need evidence for a start? Well, it must seem fairly obvious, but if we don't have evidence, we've just got people's opinions, one person against another, and I'm just as likely to be as correct as you are, or you're just as likely to be correct as I am. But certainly some people's opinions are correct. Experience counts for a lot. but it doesn't really form evidence in a very systematic way. When I trained as a nurse, and I did train, I wasn't educated as a nurse. It was a long time ago, as you can probably tell by looking at me. Authority played a great part in how things were done. Evidence didn't matter. We just got told what to do, either by the senior medic present or by the senior nurse. Expertise, fine, but you've got to be aware of expertise. You've got to be aware of people coming in and saying, hello, I'm an expert, because sometimes they're an expert and claiming to be an expert, but they don't necessarily know what they're doing. Commercial companies as well, they provide a great deal of evidence, but of course it's biased, often biased. We need to be able to evaluate this evidence and know which is the best evidence. And to use that old cliche, at the end of the day, you can have as much evidence as you like. At the end of the day was the cliche. You can have as much evidence as you like, but if you don't have the budget to implement it, then the evidence is of no good at all. So evidence is one thing, but it's got to be contextualised, it's got to be affordable, it's got to be prepared to be used where it's needed. So without evidence, we just get torn apart between different opposing views. One person thinks one thing, another person thinks another. We try to evaluate the research evidence. We see that one day a clinical trial in a drug or a clinical trial for a nursing intervention shows an effect. Other times it doesn't. We don't understand this because we're not sort of on the whole educated properly to understand things like regression towards the mean and such like. And without evidence, we just get involved in nonsense like Reiki therapy or homeopathy and all sorts of things like this. I'll put my cards on the table and say, as a former biochemist, I'm exceedingly biased against these things. But without evidence, nurses tend to get involved in many of these things which don't have any evidence. And of course, the pressure from the general public to use things that are not evidence-based is enormous. The general public couldn't care less about evidence. They want what they think is going to work for them. My wife, who often gets mentioned when I'm giving talks, takes various vitamins in the morning. I say, there's no evidence that these things do you any good, but they're costing me a fortune. But she says, well, you and your evidence, it doesn't really matter. So, you know, it's not just a matter of saying, I've got the evidence, you know, this is it. We've got to get it implemented properly, appropriately, and where it's needed. And of course, this is relevant, I guess, to Saudi, but it's certainly relevant to the Far East, where I work a lot. This is from Hong Kong in 2003, during the SARS epidemic, not dissimilar to your MERS epidemic, everyone running around wearing face masks at the behest of the Hong Kong health authorities, despite the fact there's absolutely no evidence that face masks do any good at all. In fact, they may well be harmful. So, you know, just to dispel the notion that having the evidence means anything on the ground in practice, it often doesn't. Things get done whether the evidence is there or not. And I want to get on, just in a few slides' time, to, as I say, a very practical example from the National Health Service about how evidence has been and can be implemented into practice. Now, Dr. Mohammed earlier on showed the levels of evidence pyramid. They were always very lulled to sleep by anything that's in a pyramid. Witness Maslow's hierarchy of needs, the first thing I learned about when I trained as a nurse, or various learning cycles and various theories about education. They're all sort of pyramidal or into these sort of pyramids and triangles. Again, great, absolutely correct. The highest level of evidence that we have at the moment is systematic reviews and meta-analysis, which is combined from the second level of randomised controlled trials. We tend to loop down in the rest of the levels of evidence, but they do provide some important evidence. But the point I'm trying to make is we can have as many of these sort of triangles as we want and point out as often as we want that this is the best kind of evidence. It doesn't really mean very much to the nurse working on the ward. And we do tend to get lulled to sleep by clinical trials. We want to do clinical trials of everything, even when we don't really need it. I mean, there's no need any longer, I don't think, for example, to have clinical trials of parachutes. We know they work. But we tend to think, well, we haven't got the evidence for this. We need to do a clinical trial. It isn't always quite the case. However, when we do get on to looking at clinical trials, we tend, as I say already, not to understand why one day a clinical trial doesn't show an effect and the next day it shows an effect. And basically, clinical trials are limited in the way they can show effect. They have to be aggregated together. One clinical trial, one piece of research, doesn't really show very much, because everything regresses towards the mean. This is batting averages from baseball in the USA. The batters who start low in their careers tend to get better, and the ones who start high tend to get lower. You know, we see this. It's exactly the same with clinical trials and experiments to show effects of treatments. The treatments which are way out on the treatment side, repeat them a few times, they tend to come towards the mean. The ones which are down here tend also to come towards the mean. Everything regresses towards the mean, and the effects aren't very big. So therefore we have to assimilate evidence using things like forest plots, which this is a very good one. In fact, I don't know what the particular treatment is here, but it shows that the triangle at the bottom shows that the treatment is favoured. But you know, there's a couple of trials which are over on the right-hand side, and many of the confidence intervals go over there. So it's quite tricky assessing evidence. Again, most nurses in clinical practice aren't experienced at using this, and we can produce as many of these as we like. They're probably not going to change very much down at the practice level. And we've also got to appreciate that for every piece of evidence we accumulate or publish or whatever in my journal or whatever, that everything will change. We tend to think that's it, we've got the answer, but we often haven't, because look what happened to mobile phones over the years, you know. They went from things that you had to hold in two hands down to things that you can hold in one hand. So things change. So we've also got to accommodate that. We can't just implement evidence and say that's it. We've got to review it. We've got to keep up to date. So in terms of the theories of getting evidence, there are various places you can go for this. Again, Dr. Mohammed at the beginning of the afternoon showed various places around the world. The sort of one of the best places, of course, is the Cochrane Collaboration. It provides very good evidence. I'm not going to go into any examples here, but it does have evidence there for nursing practice. Very good. It's free. As a Scotsman, that appeals to me. There's also one you may have heard of, the Joanna Briggs Institute from Australia. I think there is a Joanna Briggs Institute somewhere here in Saudi at one of the hospitals. Again, provides evidence. You have to pay into this. It's not free. There's the York Centre for Reviews and Dissemination. There's the National Institute for Health and Clinical Excellence, which I mentioned already. I'm not expecting you to note all those and keep up to them. They're easy to find on the internet. And they all contain evidence which is directly applicable to nursing practice. However, I don't know how many nurses in practice actually look at this. I don't know how many nurses in management actually look at this. I've got no idea. I tend to think, despite the quality of the evidence that's available, that it exists and very often doesn't actually get into practice. And what I want to tell you about now is an example of how I think it can be got into practice. Basically, in my opinion, getting evidence into practice doesn't happen by accident. It requires deliberate effort on the behalf of people in hospitals and trusts in my country, or in groups of hospitals and in organisations. And we've already heard some really good examples today of how that's happening and where it's happening in Riyadh and the rest of Saudi. Now, what I want to tell you about is an example from the UK, from the Sheffield Teaching Hospitals NHS Foundation Trust, which is where I used to work until recently, and it's about the evidence-based council, which is based there. The exceedingly good-looking chap in the middle is Dan Wolfenstone, and he's one of the leading lights in it. Up at the right-hand side, she's always very modest, she doesn't like having her photograph taken, is Irene Mabbitt, and down at the left is Judith and Simon Palfreyman. Now, as you can probably tell from the picture, based in Canada, but still associated with the evidence-based council, but I'll come back to that photograph in a minute. Now, I'm peripherally involved with the Evidence-Based Council because I used to work in Sheffield. I've remained a member of it. I must be one of the least active members, but I still receive their emails and their notifications of every meeting and event that they're having, and I still provide some training to the Evidence-Based Council people in Sheffield on writing for publication. But the evidence-based counsel, someone asked the question, I think it was Dr. Mohammed asked the question earlier, but how much it costs to get evidence into practice in the UK. I'll be quite frank, I haven't got a clue about the system that you were talking about. I'm not very engaged in that. But here's a group of people in Sheffield Teaching Hospitals Trust who actually don't have a dedicated budget. If they have any budget at all, it's for coffee and biscuits at meetings. They can tap into trust money for travel and going to conferences now and again. But these people all have day jobs. They're clinicians, they're teachers, they work in the training centre and whatever, but they form the evidence-based council, and it runs on a very low budget, but is very, very effective. So the evidence-based council was established in 1998 between the National Health Service and the local universities. The National Health Service in Sheffield is Sheffield Teaching Hospitals Trust. It covers the Northern General Hospital, which is the largest hospital site in Europe, I believe, and the Royal Hallamshire Hospital. And there are two local universities, the University of Sheffield and Sheffield Hallam University. So the evidence-based council has done something absolutely unique. Not only is it unique to the UK, it's got two very opposing and rival universities working together with them. It's unique to the UK. The evidence-based council isn't really visible or equivalent in other parts of the NHS. Everyone, every individual in the group has an equal voice, whether they're a clinician, an educator, or an administrator. And really its purpose is to network and to share good practice. However, it has also been involved in actually drawing up evidence for practice within the Sheffield Teaching Hospitals Trust. And that evidence has been noticed by other trusts and used elsewhere, as I'll show. I'm going to show some slides which are courtesy of Simon and Judith Palfreyman and Irene Mabbitt. I didn't draw these slides, but this is the membership of the... I'm not very keen on these sort of diagrams. We've seen a few of them today, but this is the membership of the evidence-based council. All the people that are involved in the actual National Health Service on the sort of out in the inner wheel, and then the organisations out that, the universities and the South Yorkshire, various trusts, various parts of the NHS around that particular area. And it was very clear to colleagues in the evidence-based council very early on that it had to benefit two groups of people. It had to benefit the members so that they would be seeing a value in being a part of it. They had to be empowered. The word was used a lot today, to share and evaluate evidence. They had to make a valued contribution to practice. They had to be part of disseminating good practice, and so on. So it offers something to the people who are members. It offers them the chance to get together and actually contribute to providing evidence. And it actually, you know, it's actually helped people to get published. It's helped people to get to conferences and give presentations. But of course, because it exists within the National Health Service, it has to benefit the trust. A trust is simply a group of hospitals, an organisational unit within the National Health Service. Not quite a medical city, but something like that. So it had to offer the trust effective and economic use of resources and all the other things it says here. I don't want to go through all those in any detail. But also, I think the second bottom point is very important, was to try and cut down on the repetition of projects, was to try and find out across the trust what people were doing, because the trust is pretty big, to say if somebody's doing work on pressure sores in one part of the trust, pressure injuries, sorry, if somebody's doing it somewhere else, bring them together, help them to work together to save duplicating the effort. And also to try and encourage the use of evidence-based practice, but also to try and get specific bits of evidence-based practice into practice, not just to produce them and leave them sitting around gathering dust. So the evidence-based council has had various achievements. This is by no means everything they've done, and I'm very grateful to Irene Mabbitt, one of the members, one of the leading lights, for giving me an updated list of what they've been up to. But I know some of these projects because I've been involved in them. But, you know, nutritional needs of patients in an oncology unit, I'm not going to go into any detail in these, but these are things that were noticed in clinical practice, raised in the trust, as things that needed to be solved. How could we solve them? How could we address them using evidence? Breaking bad news, always very difficult. There's lots of research out there about breaking bad news. There are lots of organisations that help it. But how did the trust help its own staff, all of the staff across the trust, to break bad news to people with life-threatening diagnosis or with relatives who'd passed away? This is not in any particular order, but generating evidence-based nursing care guidelines for the treatment of pyrexia in adults. Again, there's plenty of research on this, but this actually brings it together into a document, and they try to get things into sort of one page of A4, which people can actually have handy on the ward. They're totally against plastering every possible corner of the trust with guidelines. They try and keep them focused. They try and keep them very small, very easy to use. Simple things like promoting a good night's sleep. Again, lots of research on that. But how do you do it in your hospital? What are the problems in your hospital or your trust? How do you deal with that? Natural laxatives, as opposed to using lots of artificial laxatives, which we know are very, very harmful and also very expensive. So trying to promote good diets and helping people to lead a good life without taking lots of pills. There's another pyrexia project, which is across the trust, and also the falls and footwear project. You know, how do they address the falls happening in the hospital? What are the specific aspects of that hospital combined with available evidence that could address this particular problem? Then they produce resources which are very useful, and they're based on the project's practice development database. There's actually a database within the trust website that you can look into. You can put in search terms and find things that you want. They've got a STEPS toolkit to support evidence-based practice. This is available online as well. This actually tells people how to go about generating evidence in the trust and how the best ways are to get it into practice from their own experience. They run evidence-based practice courses, which I play a part in doing writing for publication courses. And then finally, just finishing off, various achievements that they've had. And again, this is sort of fairly random, but they've got the Let's Talk About Sex conference. Maybe you don't want to do that in Saudi Arabia, but it's not just about sex. It's about sexuality and how nurses approach these issues with patients. They have open events for the governors and the trust board, so they have the senior people along to see what they actually do. They have an annual sharing good practice festival, which I'm invited to. I rarely have the time to go to it. In fact, it's on this week, where they have posters from everyone who's done a project in the trust, and people like myself come along and comment on them. You can bring along a student from the university to the evidence-based council to see how it works. And the work of the evidence-based council has been highlighted in the Innovations and Improvement website. This is a National Health Service initiative in the past. They've got documents for helping people with Alzheimer's disease as well. They hold consultations, and they hold local, national and international networks. So they get around to conferences. They tend to hunt as a pack at the Royal College of Nursing Research Conference. They were all there in Edinburgh about 3 weeks ago, very prominently. They have a very informal approach, which seems to work. They hold debates, they help people to progress with careers, and they also develop individual researchers. And they also hold social events where people can get together and enjoy themselves. And they have a strong presence at these international conferences. And then finally, they celebrate what they do, they put things out in photographs, and the point here is that these photographs have been taken in Ireland and in Canada and in other countries. They take along posters from the actual evidence-based council and they try and get photographs taken in different places to show their influence around the world. And they firmly believe that their work is worth more than any of the individuals. It adds, you know, the sum total of what they do adds up to a great deal more than what any one of them does. So if you want to know anything about the Evidence-Based Council, you can email me if you want. The contact details are there. Irene Mabbitt's the main contact. You can find them easily on the web. As I say, I think it's a very effective, informal way of getting evidence into practice. It's been shown to work. I'm very happy to be at least peripherally associated with it and to tell you something about it here in Riyadh. So that's my contact details if anybody wants to contact me. Once again, thank you very much for the opportunity to not only address you once today, but twice.